I next met with Dr. Sunil Verma, who's been a key figure in the recent clinical research evolution of new agents in HER2-positive disease. And to better understand how he translates new findings to practice, I asked Dr. Verma to present a few of his patients, and he began with a woman with disease relapse after adjuvant treatment for HER2-positive, node-positive disease.
This is a 44-year-old female who was diagnosed with node-positive breast cancer and treated with docetaxel paclitaxel and trastuzumab and completed the trastuzumab treatment in October 2011. Hormone receptor negative, HER2 receptor positive. And I've been seeing her every 6 months or so, and then now she presents with some new onset of shortness of breath and a cough, which was quite concerning. This was new for her, didn't really have any symptoms of infection. We organized CT scan staging, and unfortunately it did reveal that she had bilateral lung metastases and as well as a small right pleural effusion. And thankfully, there was no other evidence of any visceral metastases and no CNS metastases. So recurrent HER2-positive breast cancer about 18 months or so after completing trastuzumab treatment along with previous therapy with paclitaxel chemotherapy.
I'm curious about the dyspnea. I mean, was it your impression that she had maybe lymphangitic disease, or was it the pleural effusion, or what was going on, do you think?
Yeah, so the dyspnea was definitely new for her, and she was getting more symptomatic where it was affecting her ability to take one flight of stairs in her home. And so that to me was concerning. This is an otherwise very active person, and she bounced back quite nicely after completing her trastuzumab in the adjuvant setting. So a new onset of dyspnea along with cough was definitely concerning enough that we organized the workup investigations to see what was happening.
How do you think through these situations?
The treatment options for this young lady are, do we go with a standard trastuzumab-based treatment with either paclitaxel plus trastuzumab, docetaxel trastuzumab, vinrelabine trastuzumab? Those would be sort of reasonable trastuzumab-based therapy, but I think what the data has clearly shown that if you were to incorporate pertuzumab along with trastuzumab for these patients in the first-line setting, even in the context of previous adjuvant therapy with trastuzumab, that will bode well for her with respect to improved response rate, improved progression-free survival, and now also improved overall survival. And when we're considering pertuzumab, the data is strongest for docetaxel, trastuzumab, and pertuzumab as per the CLEOPATRA study. And so we gave her the two options. We said, would you consider docetaxel, trastuzumab, pertuzumab, or would you consider paclitaxel, trastuzumab, pertuzumab? And we don't have any phase 3 data with paclitaxel, but I think the consensus is quite strong that it's the taxane component, even though important, is not critical that this treatment would be effective with the combination of a dual targeted therapy, regardless of which taxane we're using, whether it's paclitaxel or docetaxel. So she decided to proceed ahead with paclitaxel, trastuzumab, and pertuzumab.
And what happened?
So we just started the treatment 2 weeks ago, and she seems to be doing better. We haven't heard any progression of her dyspnea before she did require one thoracentesis. So she's receiving now paclitaxel, trastuzumab, pertuzumab on a Q3 weekly basis. We just feel that that is going to be the most convenient option for her instead of giving her weekly paclitaxel as we generally do. So she's getting it on a Q3 weekly dosing, and I plan to see her back next week to see how she's looking. But so far, so good. No repeat need for a thoracentesis so far.
Now, if you could have accessed T-DM1, would you have used it for her?
Yeah, so the data for trastuzumab emtansine in the Amelia study, they needed recurrence to happen within 6 months of completion of adjuvant trastuzumab. So this patient wouldn't really fit the criteria to receive trastuzumab emtansine or T-DM1 in the first-line setting as per the study protocol. In the CLEOPATRA, of course, the patients were eligible to enter the study as long as the adjuvant trastuzumab was completed 1 year and they had an adequate disease-free interval of 1 year. So I think she would be eligible to go on the CLEOPATRA study, and therefore I felt that would be a better option for this patient to give her pertuzumab-trastuzumab combination along with the taxane. I think when she progresses, of course, the option of T-DM1 is always there. And I think in this context, the data for T-DM1 is strongest for the first line if patients have a short disease-free interval of less than 6 months. And I think if this was a patient where we were facing that short disease for interval, I would have definitely considered for T-DM1. But in this case, a combination of doublet HER2-targeted therapy with pertuzumab, trastuzumab, and a taxane, and when she progresses, T-DM1 is going to be an option for her.
Anything you want to say in terms of the data that we've seen on pertuzumab, particularly the issue of predictors of response, anything out there that looks interesting to you?
Yeah, so far, I think we were all pleasantly surprised looking at the magnitude of the benefit in progression-free survival. Going into it, I still remember when I first saw the data in November of 2011, I was expecting maybe at a three-month improvement in PFS would be clinically meaningful. But when we saw this improvement from 12 to 18.5 months, 6.5 months, that is pretty impressive improvement. And the idea right at the outset was, which are the patients who are most likely to benefit? Are there a biomarker that could be identified? And of course, the one that comes to mind would be the HER3 expression, given that this is the agent that blocks the dimerization of HER2, particularly with HER3. But that's not the case. There isn't really a biomarker that has been identified. One biomarker, of course, is consideration is, you know, is prior trastuzumab potentially a predictive marker? And all we know is more likely a prognostic marker, that the likelihood of benefit remains the same with respect to whether the patients have had prior trastuzumab or not. So I think it's more a prognostic marker as to how these patients are going to do. The prognosis is slightly worse if they had prior trastuzumab, but respect to predictive marker, it's not predictive for benefit in the setting of pertuzumab.
So one study that's out there that a lot of people are looking forward to seeing the results on is the so-called Marianne trial. I wonder if you could talk about what that's looking at and any sort of predictions about what we might see.
So the Marianne trial, of course, is a pivotal trial that we're expecting the results in likely 2014. And it's a three-arm design where the patients are randomized to T-DM1 plus pertuzumab versus T-DM1 alone versus taxane plus trastuzumab. And the idea behind this is, can we combine pertuzumab with T-DM1? And I think that's really going to be the arm that is of specific interest to see whether we can improve on the outcomes. Now, what we're looking for is, can we improve on the progression-free survival outcome of about 18.5 months that we have already achieved with the Cleopatra? And would T-DM1 plus pertuzumab give us a value that is greater than 18.5 months? Now, there is no arm looking at chemo plus trastuzumab plus pertuzumab in that study, so it's all the arms are looking at either taxane plus trastuzumab versus T-DM1 versus T-DM1 plus pertuzumab. So there'll be some indirect comparison between the T-DM1 plus pertuzumab arm from the Marianne trial and the experimental arm of docetaxel, trastuzumab, and pertuzumab from the Cleopatra study. But what we're really hoping for is a PFS that is greater than 18.5 months. Now, the study populations are going to be somewhat different. Marianne is a study that was launched much later than Cleopatra, hence more patients would have had prior trastuzumab. So chances are, as I've discussed previously, prior trastuzumab is more of a prognostic factor. And in that setting, the likelihood that PFS is going to be slightly shorter because most patients would have had prior trastuzumab. So we'll be doing some indirect comparison in this setting. However, what we really want to see is how much better is the addition of pertuzumab to T-DM1 compared to T-DM1 alone and compared to historical cohort of pertuzumab, trastuzumab, and taxanes from the Cleopatra study.
Can you talk a little bit about the other trial ideas that are exploring the use of these two agents, pertuzumab as well as T-DM1, particularly in the adjuvant and neoadjuvant setting?
Yeah, so my bias when we're evaluating these agents has really, can we identify a subgroup of patients where we can get away by not giving them chemotherapy? Are we able to select a subgroup of patients where we can give this targeted approach? Mind you, DM1, of course, has a component of chemotherapy in T-DM1, but it's such a targeted chemotherapy that is not associated with the traditional side effects. So can we actually select a group of patients which would specifically benefit from T-DM1 plus pertuzumab in combination? So the studies which are outlined so far are looking at, of course, the pivotal study, the AFFINITY trial, that is nearing completion of accrual, looking at chemotherapy plus trastuzumab versus chemotherapy plus trastuzumab plus pertuzumab. This is a pivotal study evaluating, is there a benefit of additional pertuzumab in the adjuvant setting in patients with early stage breast cancer? Now, this study is just evaluating the role of additional pertuzumab, so I think it will be an important study and will add to the treatment arsenal for our patients who have HER2-positive disease. The other studies in the neoadjuvant setting are being planned and being clarified. There's a lot of discussion right now as to what these arms are going to look like. But the basic premise is that the studies are evaluating is chemotherapy plus trastuzumab as a control arm versus chemotherapy plus trastuzumab plus pertuzumab or T-DM1 plus pertuzumab. Now, there are some challenges when you're doing such a study design. Are you able to select a group of patients where you're going to give just a targeted treatment approach and not give chemotherapy? Is that reasonable? Is pathological complete response rate a reasonable endpoint when we're evaluating these patients in the neoadjuvant setting? We know that it's a reasonable endpoint for HER2-positive disease when you're looking at chemotherapy, but is it also a reasonable endpoint when we're looking at more targeted therapy? So I think that, of course, is a big question. And then the other big question that comes into play is, are we able to integrate endocrine therapy with these newer targeted therapies such as T-DM1. You know, there's generally been an understanding that we would like to avoid integrating chemotherapy and endocrine therapy together when we are giving treatment in breast cancer, that in sequence is probably better so that it doesn't affect the mechanism of action of chemotherapy. But with T-DM1, can we actually safely deliver endocrine therapy while these patients are getting T-DM1. And those are the studies which are actually being evaluated right now, both in the metastatic realm as well as the neoadjuvant realm, is the addition of anti-estrogen therapy along with T-DM1 to see whether that is safe and still maintains the efficacy for those patients who are co-positive with both hormone receptor positivity and HER2 positivity.
It's interesting because I haven't heard anybody mention that issue. Is there any specific reason? Obviously, of course, we use trastuzumab with endocrine therapy, chemo trastuzumab, I guess not so much, but more in the maintenance situation after chemo. Is there any reason to think that maybe there would be a problem?
The only rationale is just the data that we have from chemotherapy specific agents along with anti-estrogen agents to highlight that there may be a mechanistic interaction when you're giving both of these agents together. It's unlikely, but I think given that there is a chemotherapy component, I think it's very important to evaluate. And I think the other very important piece that is so very critical when we're using a more targeted approach and we are looking at patients where we are potentially not giving them chemotherapy, even in the early stage setting, is the HER2 testing. We're giving agents which are so specifically targeting the HER2 receptor, especially with T-DM1 and with pertuzumab, that we need to be completely confident that we are really dealing with HER2-positive disease. Because if we're giving these specific agents and there are patients where there may be some testing error and they're either HER2-negative, and they're likely not going to drive any benefit from these agents, at least so far as we know. So testing is of even more critical importance when we're using such specifically targeted agents without the safety net of chemotherapy. So I think our message, especially when we're incorporating these agents, is that testing, of course, is critical, but even more so critical in this targeted treatment approach setting.
That's a really good point. And of course, we've seen things for years about the issue of testing. Anything new in that regard? Right now, what do you see as, you know, potential problems that occur that you see occurring in terms of testing?
You know, I think we have gotten much better. You know, we have more than 12 years of experience now in HER2 testing. I think most pathology labs are very confident with their quality assurance process and the validity of their test process. So I think there is a comfort level there. But to the clinicians out there, it's just very important that we, at least in the early stage setting, that we are extremely confident that HER2 testing has been performed when we're using these targeted agents, especially when we are potentially going to incorporate these agents without chemotherapy. In the metastatic setting, I think, you know, it's a very interesting discussion because we are now have an increased understanding that receptor profile may change, that up to 15% of patients who are hormone receptor positive, HER2 negative, may develop HER2 positive disease, either whether it's a clonal selection or whether there is a treatment of a related evolution of disease. So I think rebiopsy, of course, is critical. And then disease heterogeneity, I think, comes into play in the metastatic setting as well. And one of the challenges that we face when we are treating patients with HER2-positive metastatic breast cancer is if the patients have had adjuvant therapy And there's about 5% of the patients who are HER2-positive may have HER2-negative disease in the metastatic setting. And are we going to deny anti-HER2 therapy to these patients based on the one biopsy result? So is that just a clonal selection process? Is that related to disease heterogeneity? Is that related to a biopsy sampling error? So I think that's a challenge that we discuss in Tumor Board and amongst our colleagues all the time for those patients who are HER2-positive in the early stage setting and now have HER2-negative disease. What to do for that patient. So I personally am much more likely to re-biopsy patients in the metastatic setting. Definitely if there's any question whether this is truly cancer or not, I think we need to document that. Whether there's any question whether this is breast cancer or not, there's a complete rationale for doing a re-biopsy in that setting. And if there is a question of whether the natural history doesn't quite fit the profile. So a patient who is hormone receptor positive, HER2 negative, who's relapsing 1-2 years after being diagnosed, that's a patient that I would definitely advocate for a rebiopsy. A patient who's hormone receptor positive, HER2 negative, relapsing 7-8 years later, bone-only disease, that kind of fits the profile. And in that setting, I think there's a discussion that can happen with the patients, but I'm not adamant that rebiopsy takes place. Now, what about the patient who is hormone receptor positive and HER2 positive? And should we rebiopsy those patients when they relapse? I think we need to just be prepared for the results. What if the biopsy result shows HER2 negativity? Are we willing to not offer these patients anti-HER2 therapy? So I think we should only be doing the test if the test results are going to change our management. So I think the clinicians need to be aware of the potential results and what they're going to do with it before making the decision of rebiopsying.
I think it's a really interesting question. I'm curious, both for ER and HER2, if you do see a patient going from positivity to negativity, does that mean that you are no longer going to use either endocrine therapy or anti-HER therapy?
Yeah, from an anti-HER therapy for those patients, HER2 positive, HER2 negative, I think, you know, there is a discussion, and we had a recent case like this where one of my colleagues suggested that they're not going to rechallenge, and I beg to defer saying that I would rechallenge, given that, you know, we may deny this patient anti-HER therapy based on one biopsy result. So I think that for anti-HER therapy, I think most of us would consider treating these patients. For anti-estrogen therapy, I think in that situation, what we may do is just initiate the patient on chemotherapy and potentially in the future, after they've had a couple of lines of chemotherapy, we consider rebiopsying the disease again before considering anti-estrogen or giving them a therapeutic trial of anti-estrogen therapy. I think that may be reasonable. But because anti-HER2 therapy immediately affects our first-line treatment decision in most cases, I think hence in that setting it's probably safer to continue and add in the anti-HER therapy. The question is, of course, is, you know, what is the potential cost of it? Other than the financial cost of adding the anti-HER therapy, thankfully, the toxicity profile of these agents is safe enough that I think the risk of harm is low, that it's better to add rather than not to add and delete this therapy from a treatment option.
You mentioned toxicity. I'm curious, now that these agents have been out there a little bit, what your perception is clinically about toxicity. In terms of pertuzumab, it doesn't seem like there's very much out there, but one thing I've heard about is dermatologic toxicity, although I'm curious whether you've actually seen it. And in terms of T-DM1, I guess the two things that have been talked about is thrombocytopenia and liver function abnormalities, and what your experience has been with that.
Yeah, so the toxicity profile with pertuzumab, I think, has been pretty well studied and reported in the CLEOPATRA study. There is increased rates of rash. In our clinical opinion, they're not that bothersome. You know, we have gotten very comfortable in managing rash with TKIs and with EGFR-targeted therapies. And there is increased reports of diarrhea. And I think that increase in diarrhea is probably a combination of docetaxel and the pertuzumab, because outside of using docetaxel, the diarrhea rates are, again, quite low. There is, of course, increased febrile neutropenia that was reported as well in the CLEOPATRA study, where the rates of febrile neutropenia increased from 7% up to about 13%. But I think that, again, is probably related to the docetaxel, the diarrhea associated with docetaxel, and potentially disturbance of the GI mucous membranes and maybe introduction of microorganisms through that disruption that's contributing to the higher rates of febrile neutropenia. I think when we take a look at some of the data from paclitaxel-based regimen with pertuzumab or vinorelbine, the rates of febrile neutropenia are not as high. So I think that really has positioned paclitaxel to be a better partner with trastuzumab and pertuzumab when we're considering it. The T-DM1 data from a toxicity perspective, there's no doubt in our minds that it is one of the most effective and least toxic agents that we have in the breast cancer armamentarium for our patients. The patients generally sail through the treatment. There's no nausea, vomiting, there's no hair loss, there's no risk of febrile neutropenia and infection. So from those bothersome quality of life affecting toxicities, we do not see. However, there are three toxicities that we educate our patients before initiating therapy, and we have to educate clinicians when they're using these drugs. One is thrombocytopenia. The thrombocytopenia toxicity is real. We see rates of grade 3-4 thrombocytopenia in the 10 to 15% range. And thankfully, the risk of life-threatening bleeding is quite low. The risk of life-threatening bleeding in the Amelia trial was less than 1% for both the T-DM1 arm and the capecitabine and lapatinib arm. So the thrombocytopenias usually don't lead to life-threatening bleeding. What generally tends to happen is that patients notice nosebleeds around day 8 to day 10 after receiving T-DM1. That's where sort when the nadir takes place, and in most cases it recovers. But it is an abnormality that we need to be aware of, we need to educate our patients about, and of course requires dose modification if it's persistent and if it's not improving. The liver toxicity, of course, the rates of grade 3-4 hepatotoxicity were in the range of about 5% in the Amelia trial. So this is, again, a hematological assessment and a biochemical assessment that we need to follow every 3 weeks for these patients, and we need to modify the dose based on these parameters. There have been reports of liver-associated drug injury, and there has been about 5 or 6 cases of patients who have died in the more than 2,000 patients who were treated with T-DM1 in a clinical trial setting. However, I think from a clinician perspective, that rate is quite low. We need to inform the clinicians that they need to monitor the hepatic blood work for these patients every 3 weeks, and then we need to be able to modify the dose accordingly. There's one very rare side effect, focal nodular hyperplasia, where patients may have liver toxicity, but that does not translate into elevations in their liver enzymes. And this is something that there needs to be high index of clinical suspicion. And usually it's toxicity seen where patients may exhibit signs of portal hypertension, or there is CT evidence of portal hypertension in a setting of a normal liver parenchyma. And when this happens, again, these have been just reported cases. Now we inform our patients that we should probably discontinue T-DM1. And the rates of this happening is less than 1% in the clinical trial setting. But the clinicians do need to be aware that there is this possible focal nodular hyperplasia that may take place for rare patients when they're receiving T-DM1. We do not see neuropathy in the clinical practice with this agent to a much greater degree. Grade 3-4 neuropathy was around 1.4%. And there are reported cases of pneumonitis. And if we do see pneumonitis with T-DM1, it's definitely a significant reaction and advises to discontinue therapy. But again, the rates of pneumonitis are less than 1% rates. So overall, a very well-tolerable drug, a very effective drug, and the patients feel like their quality of life is much better. They're able to lead a normal life. However, liver platelets need to be monitored, and the patients need to be educated about potential pneumonitis as well.
This nodular hyperplasia is interesting. I've never heard about it. Have you seen any patients with it?
No, I haven't seen patients with it, but of course, in my involvement with the clinical trial, we were very involved in monitoring for this. So this is, again, it's in the setting of patients who are getting the treatment but developing portal hypertension on the CT scans, most likely, and, you know, where they may have some varices, splenomegaly, they may have some abdominal discomfort. And even though the rates are quite low, the challenge is that if you continue to give the drug for these patients developing portal hypertension with focal nodular hyperplasia, that we may worsen their liver status. So I think the clinicians just need to be aware of it, that this is a rare but possible toxicity, so that they are more careful and watchful of it.
It's really interesting. How do you approach the patient who has liver function abnormality at baseline from the metastatic disease in terms of using T-DM1?
Yeah. So I think, you know, the challenge there is that We always have to take a look at other treatment options and all treatment options for the patients when they have liver toxicity. In the study, they could have up to 2.5 times upper limit of normal to be entered the study. They have done a recent study looking at giving T-DM1 in patients who have significant liver abnormalities up to 10 times upper limit of normal, but those results are not available to us yet. So I think up to 2.5 times, I think we are safe. We are able to give it. But if it's between 2.5 to 5 times upper limit of normal, it requires dose modification. It requires a discussion with the patient as to the potential safety concerns. But I think if it's above 5 times upper limit of normal, I wouldn't use it. And I would probably look at other treatment options for those patients and see whether we can improve the liver function and maybe consider T-DM1 thereafter.
Just to finish out in HER2-positive disease, any new agents or new strategies being looked at that have you excited?
Yeah, I think if we take a look at where we have come from, it's quite impressive. A decade ago in the pivotal Sleiman trial that was published in 2001, the overall survival for patients receiving chemotherapy alone in patients who are HER2 positive was 20 months. The overall survival for patients now receiving chemo plus trastuzumab plus pertuzumab is in excess of 45 months. So we have nearly doubled the overall survival of these patients. And if you take a look at our own data for T-DM1 in the first, second, third line setting, majority of patients getting in second line, their overall survival is 31 months. So there has been a remarkable improvement in the overall survival for these patients over the past decade with the treatment options that we have. So where do we go from here? And I think the more important clinical questions and the research questions that I have that I think need to be addressed are the following. Number one, who are the patients who are at risk for CNS and brain metastases? 40% of our HER2-positive patients will get brain mets. Who are these patients? What are the predictive factors? What is the disease factors that predispose them for developing brain metastases? How can we identify those patients? And what agents can we use to help target brain metastases? So I think that is a significant piece of research that is missing right now. The second significant piece that's missing in the metastatic setting, I think this is going to be so very critical moving forward, is how long do we need to continue to treat these patients with targeted therapies? And a case and example, of course, is we have a patient who is getting trastuzumab plus chemotherapy, has a wonderful response, nearly a complete response. We continue on with the trastuzumab. And the trastuzumab, we have some patients who are now 7 or 8 years out with trastuzumab. And now if you're going to start integrating pertuzumab, we may have these dual targeted therapies for these patients for a significant duration of time. Are we able to identify which patients may be cured? Are we able to identify which patients have disease that's in stagnation? Can we give interrupted therapy for some of these patients after 2 or 3 years? Are we able to identify which patients do not have significant disease activity that when the disease activity increases, that's the time to reintroduce the therapy? So the initiation of circulating tumor cells and maybe circulating tumor DNA to help guide the duration of therapy, I think is going to be a pivotal next step in research in the HER2-positive realm. The third interesting piece is going to be, of course, biomarkers. And these are agents which come at a significant financial cost. And we have patients who do just fine with trastuzumab and chemotherapy. Who are those patients? And we have some patients who truly benefit for the addition of pertuzumab. So as you outlined, are there any biomarkers in clinical practice right now? The answer is no. But could there be biomarkers? I think, of course, there have to be some significant biomarkers as we take a look at incorporation of these treatments and have predictive utility. And our own data from the Amelia study suggested that maybe HER2 mRNA increases the likelihood of which patients are more likely to benefit from T-DM1. However, at the same time, patients who have low HER2 mRNA still drive a benefit, so it's not a clinically useful predictive biomarker. And the other biomarker, of course, which is of interest is PI3 kinase mutations. The PI3 kinase mutations suggest that those patients who have PI3 kinase mutations may not drive a significant benefit with lapatinib, but they did drive a significant benefit with T-DM1. Now, we've already incorporated T-DM1 earlier than lapatinib, so it doesn't help us that much. But maybe looking at these patients with these biomarkers and potentially selecting the newer generation of targeted therapies for these specific biomarkers is going to be the step forward.
So let's talk a little bit about endocrine therapy, metastatic breast cancer. And I see you were part of a guidelines paper with, I see Kathy Pritchard and Dr. Gelman and others looking at endocrine therapy in postmenopausal patients who have advanced breast cancer after progression on a non-steroidal aromatase in a very common situation. Maybe we can talk about your 57-year-old lady sort of to get into that.
Yeah, so this was a recent patient, a 57-year-old patient with metastatic breast cancer with bony mets who has a previous history of stage 2 disease, and she completed her chemotherapy and completed her tamoxifen now going back about 3 years ago. And 1 year ago, she had recurrence with bony mets in March of 2012, and she was treated with letrozole at that time. And after being treated with letrozole for now about 15 months, she's now progressing with bony mets and two new liver lesions. And the liver lesions, the maximal size was about 2 centimeters. So the decision point for this patient is the following. Do we try another anti-estrogen agent, potentially considering this patient for fulvestrant or maybe exemestane? Or do we try an anti-estrogen agent along with everolimus, so looking at exemestane plus everolimus, or do we consider chemotherapy for this patient? This is a patient who has had previous AC chemotherapy. She hasn't had taxane. She hasn't had capecitabine. So is that a reasonable option for this patient? So it's a very common concern, and I think that was the reason and the rationale for us to try and work on this guidance document that we did in Canada to try and take a look at this evidence that we have to date and try and make it as practical as possible for clinicians to be able to apply it. And I think the overarching theme from our paper is the following. If you have a patient who has significant symptomatic visceral disease, that patient needs chemotherapy. There is no doubt in my mind the likelihood of response is much higher with chemotherapy. The quickness of effect with chemotherapy will lead to significant symptomatic benefit for most of these patients. So chemotherapy is still tried, tested, and proven for those patients with symptomatic visceral disease.
In terms of that, a lot of people will then follow up a short course of chemotherapy in the situation you described, particularly if the patient sort of stabilizes with the chemo with endocrine therapy. And when you get to endocrine therapy, are you then essentially facing the same kind of decision in terms of which endocrine therapy, everolimus, et cetera, as maintenance?
Yeah, so our use of maintenance treatment after chemotherapy, I tend to sort of continue on with the chemotherapy and dose modified, extend the duration of treatment and keep the patient on treatment as long as they're responding, as long as they're tolerating it. I think the data, again, is very strong to suggest that the longer we maintain these patients on chemotherapy, the more likely they'll have a greater benefit and potentially improvement in overall survival as well. We have some meta-analysis to suggest that. We have some Asian data to suggest that continued therapy until progression is of benefit as long as the patients are tolerating it well, it's not affecting their quality of life. If I'm going to maintain these patients, I'd rather maintain these patients on anti-estrogen alone approach and only consider adding in everolimus upon the time of disease progression because, you know, again, we are not quite sure when you're maintaining these patients if it's just the effect of chemotherapy that's leading to this maintenance effect or is it really the treatment that we're giving them and why subject these patients to additional toxicity if their disease is under control and they're in a maintenance setting. So from our guidance document, we had clearly established those patients who have symptomatic visceral disease, chemotherapy is the way to go. We also felt that those patients who had very low disease burden and had maybe some bony disease but not significant bony burden of disease and have had prior good response to anti-estrogen treatment, that I would consider those patients for a second-line anti-estrogen alone approach. But then there is this mixed group of patients from patients who have significant burden of bony disease, symptomatic bony disease, to those patients who have visceral disease and potentially liver lung involvement, but they're asymptomatic, but they do have visceral disease. I think that's really where an anti-estrogen plus everolimus approach should be considered to see whether we can delay the need for chemotherapy. You're giving these patients more effective treatment than the traditional anti-estrogen therapy and whether there is going to be a benefit for this subgroup of patients. And I think that's really an approach that I tend to use in my clinical practice as well, is taking a look at what kind of response they've had to prior anti-estrogen treatment, what is their disease burden right now, and what are the possible treatment options, and based on that, making a choice between chemo, anti-estrogen treatment alone, versus anti-estrogen plus everolimus.
What endocrine therapy are you comfortable combining with everolimus? Of course, the trial itself that looked at exemestane, there's some data on tamoxifen. I'm not sure I've seen anything with fulvestrant, but what kind of hormone therapy are you comfortable combining?
So the data, in my mind, really speaks to that you need to block the mTOR pathway and you need to block the estrogen pathway in some way. And I'm not convinced that even though the phase 3 evidence, of course, strongly is for the combination of everolimus plus exemestane. But I think to me, it's really an anti-estrogen agent. So I'm comfortable in giving these patients tamoxifen, a non-steroidal aromatase inhibitor. The data for fulvestrant is, of course, not quite there, so I haven't used fulvestrant plus everolimus, but either tamoxifen or another anti-aromatase inhibitor, I think it makes perfectly logical sense to consider for these patients. So we have data for tamoxifen from the TAMRAT study. We have the data from letrozole from the neoadjuvant Baselga trial with everolimus. So I think it's really the combination of an anti-estrogen approach plus everolimus, and doesn't quite have to be exemestane only.
I really like the graphic you all included in this paper that summarizes the various trials that have looked at these kinds of questions. And one of the things that's mentioned in here is the question of aromatase inhibitor plus fulvestrant. What are your thoughts about that strategy? Do you ever use it?
So there were wonderful, elegant work by Brody in the lab suggesting that the combination of aromatase inhibitors plus fulvestrant would be very effective for patients in the preclinical sense. However, I think in the clinical sense, that data really has not translated into benefit. I do not use fulvestrant in combination with aromatase inhibitor. I think the recent SOFIA trial that was presented about a year ago, which looked at fulvestrant plus aromatase inhibitor versus exemestane alone versus fulvestrant alone showed really no difference in the addition of aromatase inhibitor plus fulvestrant. Of course, the FACT data also didn't show that. And the SWOG study did suggest that there was a benefit, but it was a benefit seen in a hormone-naive patient population. So if one was to hypothesize, I think my hypothesis would be that in a hormone treatment-naive patient population, that there may be a benefit with the addition of fulvestrant plus aromatase inhibitor, but that's a very small subset of patients. I think in most patients who have relapsed after receiving anti-estrogen treatment, or potentially we're considering second or third line treatment, I would just use fulvestrant alone and not combining it with aromatase inhibitors.
Any thoughts about the research strategy of using mTOR inhibitors plus endocrine therapy in endocrine-naive patients, either in the metastatic setting or the adjuvant trials?
Yeah, so in the metastatic setting, I think there is significant interest to take a look at these agents in the first-line setting. And in my mind, what the new adjuvant study showed us was that mTOR is an important pathway for breast cancer, even in the context of treatment-naive patient population. And in a neoadjuvant setting where the patients were randomized to letrozole versus letrozole plus everolimus, the data showed that the addition of letrozole plus everolimus led to improvement in these patients achieving a drop in Ki-67 even greater than letrozole alone. The numbers were from 30% to 60%. And this is only after 2 weeks of therapy that these patients are getting a biopsy and we're seeing such dramatic results. And this is a treatment-naive patient population. There's no involvement of resistance in this setting. There's no discussion of resistance. This is in the development or the evolution of breast cancer early on that the mTOR is playing a critical pathway. So I think that to me really suggests that there is going to be a role of everolimus in the first line setting, in the metastatic setting. And I think it really gives a lot of interest of studying this drug in the early breast cancer setting as well. And as we know, there's at least 3 large adjuvant trials which are underway evaluating everolimus in the adjuvant setting. Now, one of the challenges, of course, of studying this drug in the adjuvant setting is that we're studying it for hormone receptor positive patient population that has an excellent prognosis to begin with. So we need to be very smart to make sure that we identify the appropriate patient who are more at risk of disease recurrence and more likely to have a better risk-benefit analysis if there is going to be a benefit associated with those agents. And in most cases, the trials are looking at those patients with significant nodal involvement or those patients who have a high recurrence score or other adverse prognostic factors and only selecting these patients for study eligibility. And I think that is the correct approach.
I don't know if you've had any patients on those studies, but I'm just kind of curious what you think it might be like or is like to try to get a patient through an mTOR inhibitor in the adjuvant setting? And it kind of ties into a question I was going to ask you before, which is what fraction of patients just sort of cruise through without any problems whatsoever? And how many patients do have problems? And what do you think it's going to be like in the adjuvant setting?
Yeah, we are discussing involving our center with adjuvant study. So we don't have the adjuvant trial open yet. So we don't have experience of giving everolimus to patients who have finished chemotherapy and giving them 1 year of treatment. But I think in our own experience, both participating in the BOLERO-2 study and using this agent after it's been approved, I would say there's probably about 40 to 50% of patients who go through a treatment with minimal side effects. There's probably about 20% of patients who have symptoms and side effects that are leading to dose reductions and are leading to maybe treatment interruptions. And there's another 20% of patients where we really have to consider significant dose reductions, significant treatment interruptions, or potentially discontinuing the therapy. So that's the breakdown in my mind for these patients.
So let's finish out talking about triple negative disease. And again, I see you have a great paper targeting triple negative breast cancer, optimizing therapeutic outcomes in the Annals of Oncology. Well, let's talk about your 37-year-old lady to sort of get into that.
The triple negative, of course, is what I term the next frontier in breast cancer. This is a mixed bag of tumors, which we have inappropriately termed triple negative because we are not quite sure what's driving the cancer for most of these patients. What I'm really looking forward to is the next 10 years of research where we will move away from using the term triple negative breast cancer, really identifying these patients by what's driving the cancer, not by what's not driving the cancer. So this 37-year-old triple negative patient presents with locally advanced breast cancer. She was treated with docetaxel paclitaxel chemotherapy in the neoadjuvant setting, and she had a moderate response. And the treatment appeared to be clinically effective. The tumor size did decrease. She underwent a mastectomy. And at the time of mastectomy, she had a 3-centimeter residual disease with 2 out of 11 lymph nodes involved. And the question, of course, now for these patients are, should this patient receive further adjuvant chemotherapy? So she's had anthracycline, she's had taxanes in the neoadjuvant setting. She still has residual disease at the time of surgery. Is there a role for additional adjuvant chemotherapy? And it's a very difficult question. The right answer for this patient is no, because we have no evidence to date that further adjuvant chemotherapy after somebody who has had anthracyclines and taxanes would be of benefit. But this is, I think, really a great way to evaluate new therapies, to try and enrich patients who have already identified themselves not to have chemosensitive disease and enrich a subset of patients who are at greater risk of recurrence, and evaluating patients who still have residual disease after receiving neoadjuvant treatment is the subset of patients where newer drugs need to be evaluated to see whether they can do better than observation alone, which would be the standard of care. So one of the approaches which is being considered by our South American colleagues in a study that we're hoping to see the results in the next few months is looking at capecitabine. Should these patients get capecitabine afterwards for a determined length of time? There's also discussion of looking at Erublin for these patients after they've had neoadjuvant therapy and still have residual disease versus observation. So the Erublin trial, which is a planned trial, I think would be of significant interest. And the other, of course, chemotherapy agent, which we feel has a role in triple negative diseases, is platinums. And platinums, of course, due to their DNA damaging effect, clearly have a role in BRCA-related triple negative breast cancer. The data in the neoadjuvant setting for patients with BRCA-related breast cancer suggests a pathological complete response rate, even with single agent cisplatin, of close to 75%. And the recent data that was presented at ASCO, looking at the combining platinums with standard conventional chemotherapy, suggests that maybe patients who have BRCA-associated breast cancer, or maybe patients who have BRCA-ness to their breast cancer, which may be measured in different manners, may be the patient subgroup which are the ones who will drive a benefit with the addition of platinums. So I think moving forward for triple-negative breast cancer in the adjuvant to new adjuvant setting is we need to come up with either a gene signature or a tumor signature, a profile of patients who are more likely to drive a benefit either with platinums alone or platinums in combination with standard anthracyclines and taxanes, because I think that is going to help improve the outcomes of these patients in their early stage setting in a very cost-effective, reasonably well-tolerated class of drugs that we have had for many decades that we just are not quite sure which patients are more likely to benefit.
You mentioned eribulin, and I'm curious what your thoughts are about that agent and also the trial that compared it to capecitabine that was presented last year at San Antonio.
Yeah, so the eribulin versus capecitabine study showed that overall the outcomes of the patients were the same when you received eribulin versus capecitabine when you look at progression-free survival or overall survival. But in patients who were triple negative, there was a significant benefit favoring the eribulin arm. And I think that's where I would position eribulin in the metastatic setting, is that I would position it prior to capecitabine for those patients who have triple negative disease. And I think that's what the data suggests. It's a very well tolerated drug. Neutropenia is there, but the neutropenia tends to be a little bit more persistent, but it doesn't have acute drops in neutrophil counts. And the rates of febrile neutropenia, at least in the study, were only 5%. So there were not significant febrile neutropenia rates that were seen in the study. So neutropenia is there and hair loss is there, but the neuropathy is very manageable with this drug. It was grade 3 neuropathy rate was around 8% or so. So I think eribulin definitely has a role for those patients who have had prior anthracycline and taxane chemotherapy, and in triple negative prior to capecitabine, and in non-triple negative patients after capecitabine.